You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
Happy New Year. This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. It's really about time for another Atomic Show. The last one was on September 10th, 2010. It's been a real busy time for me since then, and anyway, it's time to get started. My New Year's resolution is to provide you with a podcast now and again. I should be able to meet that one. This is show number 162, and with me I have three outstanding guests who will each introduce themselves and tell you a little bit about why they think that maybe the real greetings for the day should be Happy Nuke Year.
Hi, this is Meredith Angwin. I blog at Yes Vermont Yankee, and I'm also head of the recently formed Ethan Allen Institute Energy Education Project. As you can tell by the name Vermont and the Ethan Allen Institute, I'm in Vermont, and I'm really happy to be here. I would like to be really upbeat about the year and say it's going to be happy nuke year because we're going to have all this great new nuclear activity. But for me, really, it's nuke decision year because basically Vermont Yankee is scheduled to shut down in 2012, and if the decision isn't made in 2011 to continue, then it will not continue. This is the year the decision will be made.
And I'm Margaret Harding. I think it's going to be Happy Nuke Year. I'm positive that the decision will be the right one on Vermont Yankee, just because I'm a positive kind of girl. I've had a 2010 has been an interesting year. I think there's been a lot of good and a lot of bad. I've spent a lot of time with young folks at colleges, mostly at Iowa State, but also with my son's friends. And I hear a lot of good, positive feeling about nuclear energy with the environmentalists of the 20s and late teens and early 20s. And I think that's going to be just great for us in this industry.
This is Dan Yerman. I blog at Idaho Semizat, and also I am a contributing reporter for Fuel Cycle Week, where I cover the uranium mining industry in the U.S. and Canada. I think this will be a good year for the global nuclear industry in China, India, and the U.K., not so much in the U.S., where we've got a bad case of, I say, yellow flag, if to use a NASCAR term, if that's the right flag color, with Constellation Project taking a step back. On the other hand, I think Areva will get the license for their enrichment plant in Idaho this year, so these things tend to balance out.
Okay. Well, you know, you bring up one of the more interesting discussions of the entire 2010 when you mentioned the Constellation Energy, Calvert Cliffs Unit 3, up and down and essentially out in terms of Constellation. Right now, it seems that the project is being held up partly because the remaining owner of the Unistar, the EDF, Electricité de France, doesn't qualify to own a nuclear power plant in the United States because of what I think is an obsolete provision of the Atomic Energy Act of 1954. What do you all think about the restriction on having a majority foreign owner of a U.S. nuclear power plant?
Well, I think it's silly. I mean, in 1954, there weren't that many multinationals, and now they're just, everything is. I mean, you have majority foreign owners of car assembly plants in the Midwest. You have Ben and Jerry's, the Vermont icon is owned by Unilever of Rotterdam. I mean, it just seems ridiculous to me.
I also think that defining a U.S. owned company in many ways is difficult. So many of the nuclear vendors are sort of U.S., sort of. So why do we care if the plants are being run by U.S. owned companies? What difference does that make?
You know, this is going to be a very gray area, and I'll point to a couple of examples. Westinghouse is building reactors at Southern. Westinghouse is owned by Toshiba, a Japanese company.
And Kazakhstan.
That's a minority share. NRG in South Texas, Toshiba is supplying the reactors, and Tokyo Electric Power, a utility, has taken a stake in the company. I think there's actually a solution for Calvert Cliffs, and that is for Unistar and EDF to form a independent power producer and sell shares of the reactor to a variety of utilities. I think any of the utilities in the U.S. want to take on a major stake in it, but if you were to sell the shares in the plant in 100 to 500 megawatt slices, I think that you would probably find some willing investors who would want to not want to bet the entire utility, but might want to take a bet for 100 megawatts of power. If you have enough domestic companies that buy those shares, then you've solved your problem of foreign ownership, and you've gotten investor financing at the same time. I'm going to take a contrary position, though, relative to my colleagues on the call, relative to foreign ownership. And I think that national energy security still plays a role. And that there are some places where the government has an interest in ensuring that its domestic interests are covered by U.S. companies and where it has control. And I think nuclear energy is one of those.
Okay, well, but the problem is, from a domestic energy point of view, there's no restriction on a foreign ownership of coal plants. There's no restriction on foreign ownership of natural gas plants. And in terms of ownership of intellectual property, it's pretty absurd, patently absurd, to believe that Electricité de France, which owns, 58 operating nuclear power plants in France, would learn anything that they don't already know by owning a nuclear power plant in the United States.
Well, I think that's true. I think the area where you have an interest, I'm going to shift ground from the United States to Europe. As people on this call know, Germany stepped back from shutting down their 17 reactors and are going to continue to operate some of them until 2024 and more of them for another 8 years. Had they not done that, the Czech Republic was getting ready to build $25 billion worth of new nuclear power plants at Temelin with the idea of supplying electricity to Germany. And as people know, the three bidders for that plant were Areva and Westinghouse and Rosatom, the Russian nuclear export agency. Now, one of the things that's happened over there is very interesting is that the Czechs have said, look, localization, which is suppliers for the plant, the majority of them, to the extent practical, must come from Czechoslovakia. And the Russians are very interested in dominating energy in Europe. So the Russians immediately started placing orders for nuclear components with Czech companies for reactors to be built in Vietnam. By the time the award comes along, there's only one place that is going to be able to supply the localization component, and that is the Russian contracts that are already in place in Czechoslovakia. The Russians would then, under this scenario, win the award for Temelin, and then instead of controlling natural gas for Germany, would control electricity for Germany. Well, it hasn't worked out that way because the Germans saved their reactors. But if you look at the scenario, you can see that energy security relative to state-owned nuclear corporations is a new area of competition. And in state-to-state relations, I think that the United States has an interest in having control there. Now, on the other hand, I can balance those comments by pointing out that about 50% of the uranium that's burned in U.S. utilities right now comes through the megatons to megawatts program, which is operated by USEC. And that means that since 20% of the electricity in the U.S. comes from nuclear reactors, it means 10% of the electricity in the U.S. comes from Russian uranium. So that's pretty interesting. So there's a lot of gray areas here. I still think that the United States has an interest in ensuring that in the area of nuclear materials, that U.S. corporations are at the forefront.
But as Margaret pointed out, in today's world, how do you define a U.S. corporation?
Very good question.
Particularly, I mean, heck, it's hard to define the U.S. government as being U.S. owned. I mean,
there's a thought,
Ron. Who's our major bondholders?
I'm not going to be able to finish this conversation if you come out with another one like that.
You gave him a spit take there.
Who's our major bondholders in the U.S.? It used to be Americans who owned all the bonds, but that doesn't hold true anymore, right? It's an awful lot of our bonds being held by other folks. Who
a lot of bonds are held by China.
And Japan and Germany and
yeah, but
and
China's
Saudi
our biggest.
Arabia and
my understanding is China is our largest debt holder at the moment.
Yes, that is correct. But they're not the only ones. And
no, that's true.
Go ahead.
Can I get back to a thought about energy security for a few minutes? I think that there's a differentiation that we could make between who builds and even operates the plant, which is in the United States, and the problems that the Europeans have, and to some extent that Vermont has. You say Vermont, okay. What I mean is what the Europeans are very uneasy about is the idea that all their energy, not it comes from plants or sources outside their borders. That is, you know, Germany is getting natural gas in from Russia. And what if Russia decides, hey, we don't want to give you natural gas anymore. We're closing it off. Too bad. That's what Germany worries about. And similarly, you know, the idea that the Russians might build a plant in Germany, I mean, maybe they would be really upset about it in Germany. I don't know. But the idea is if the plant's on German soil, then the Germans own it, even if it happens to be owned and operated by some people from a different country. And the same here. If the plant's on American soil, it's an American plant, whoever's owning and operating it, because we can control it. Now, when I said, and what about Vermont, you know, the people who want to shut down Vermont Yankee, I've been blogging about this a bit, they're always saying things like, well, we can get it all from Hydro-Quebec. We can get all the power we need from Hydro-Quebec. Well, Hydro-Quebec always already provides us with a third of the power. We could find
Hello?
Ourselves.
Hey, Charles. I'm sorry,
Hi.
Meredith. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I was adding Charles in here.
I'm delighted to have Charles added in. I'll just finish my sentence in saying that I think it would be uncomfortable for Vermont to shut down Vermont Yankee and get two-thirds of its power from Canada, just like the Europeans aren't happy with the idea of too much of their power coming from Russia or the Italians too much of their power coming from France and so forth and so on.
Right. Part of the issue in Europe is the Russians have proven at least twice that they are perfectly willing to close the valves to the pipelines that go into Europe. They've done it twice, and they have control over those valves. And unlike uranium, which you can store a massive amount of at your plant, if you're running a natural gas plant, you need that gas to come pretty much every day.
Yeah, and we think of Canada as a politically stable country, but the people of Quebec keep making rumblings that they want to secede from Canada. And so you wonder what's going to happen to those power contracts if Quebec were to secede from the rest of Canada.
Well, it's not Quebec, right? Isn't it, Meredith? Isn't
it is Quebec. I don't know where this Ontario thing began happening, but basically we buy from Hydro-Quebec. That's the people we buy from.
It's the interconnects, Meredith. This is Dan. Here's what's happening. I think we'll put this in context. In Ontario, Bruce Power operates a number of reactors. They're taking those reactors offline in the next year, and they'll be offline for up to 18 months, possibly longer. And I'll explain why in a moment. When that happens, power will be wheeled from Hydro-Quebec to Ontario. It will not be available to Vermont. So if someone wants to shut down Vermont Yankee and thinks they're going to get power from Quebec, they better think again, because that power is going to Ontario, because Bruce Power is shutting down its reactors. Now, the reason that it could take longer than 18 months is that AECL, which will be doing the refurbishment, has made hash brown potatoes, basically, out of the refurbishment of the Port La Pro reactor in New Brunswick province. It's way, it's double of over $400 million over budget. The replacement power is in the tens of millions of dollars. And the province is now telling the federal government, Ottawa, you need to pay for these cost overruns and the replacement power. And the federal government is saying, no, we're not. This is an AECL deal. The other thing that's going on in Canada is that the federal government is trying to sell AECL. And so far, the bids that have come in have pretty much been fire sale prices, which would be an embarrassment if they inked a contract for that. So it's a very unstable situation up there as far as power is concerned. And you're not going to get replacement power from Canada if Vermont Yankee closes. So that's where the Ontario piece fits in.
I just wanted to point out that they have promised us they have a contract with us to provide almost as much power as they do now, which is about a third of it. They claim they'll go up to two-thirds if Vermont Yankee closes. I have always doubted that. And also, they have also said, which is absolutely true, that when people, in 1998, a fierce ice storm brought down the lines from Quebec, and Vermont lost about a third of its power. And they've said, well, this can never happen again. And the ministers in Canada have said, but it will happen again. I mean, it won't happen again tomorrow, and we're trying to upgrade and blah, blah, but... You know, we're in the north up here, and we're bringing that power down from North Country, and every now and again, something comes up and just shuts down our lines.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Meredith, that Hydro-Quebec will sell you approximately as much power as they're selling to you now, but that does not make up for losing what Vermont Yankee puts out.
Exactly, exactly. But the locals always act as if, but of course, we'll just get a little more. Anyway, enough about this.
Yeah,
Let's go on to another.
I mean, a lot of people like to spend the same dollar two or three times in their own mind. They don't realize that you can't.
Right.
Same thing with electricity. You know, if you have a need for 200 megawatts and there's 100 megawatts available, half of your customers are not going to have power. You know, you can't just turn on, you know, plug in another cord. Hey, my point on this is, if the U.S. insists that we can't have foreign ownership of a nuclear plant in Maryland, the answer may very well be that there will be no nuclear plant built there. Because if I was EDF, particularly after what they've learned in the last couple of years, I wouldn't trust a single American company to have the stick-to-itness to be my partner.
Well, let's put the shoe on the other foot here. Let's take a look at EDF's situation and see where is the capital coming from EDF to build the plant, assuming everything else was okay. EDF is deeply in debt. EDF is making major commitments to build reactors in the UK. The replacements of French reactors are coming up, and the French government will make those projects a priority. My question for EDF, exactly where is the capital coming from to build Calvert Cliffs 3, assuming you're able to deal with the other legal issues?
Well, there's been a couple of things that EDF has done very recently, which is to sell off other assets that are not associated with their nuclear business. And as I recall, the deal recently was it would give them a net of about almost 7 billion euros to sell off some of their non-nuclear UK electricity distribution networks.
That's about a third of what they need.
Okay,
they need around 20 billion.
A third is a good down payment.
It's a third as good down payment.
It's a good down payment. I mean, I just financed a house. I didn't put down a third.
I know.
Okay, but, so a third is a good down payment.
If you look at all the commitments they've made, I still think they're overextended.
If they don't sell any of their stock to the stock market, I agree with you. However, EDF right now is owned about 90% by the French government, which has been reluctant to go to the capital markets. However, if EDF had a bunch of contracts and they decided they would do a public offering, I personally believe they would be able to attract a fair amount of capital.
Well, there's a couple of things to look at here. First of all, Areva just did go to capital markets, and they raised $900 million. They need $4 billion. They only raised $900 million. And the way they got the money is they got $600 million from the Kuwaitis. And that was a tough sell. The Kuwaitis had a condition, and that is that Areva not sell any shares below the price at which they were purchased by Kuwait. They got another $300 million from the French government, and they're raising additional money by selling a portion, an electronics subsidiary. So that's one thing that's going on. But one of the problems that you run into when you start moving this kind of money around is that there are only so many people who can play with money at this level. And an example for Areva was Qatar wanted to buy into Areva, but they weren't interested in buying the nuclear side. They wanted an interest in Areva's uranium mines because China is buying uranium hand over fist. Areva said, no, we're not doing that. So the Qatar deal didn't go through. There are other ways that capital can be raised, but selling shares to other actors inevitably brings in sovereign wealth funds and now becomes a matter of relations among nations rather than relations between banks.
Well, that's private placements. That's not right. Going to the public markets. Big difference. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay.
That anyway, sounds like a
Yeah, so that's just going to the public market. That's not going to the public market, which is what I'm referring to.
Well, how many shares do you think the French government will let EDF sell?
I don't know. That's what I would do if I was the French government, but I'm certainly not there. So, hey, Charles, how are you doing these days?
Well, my health is beginning to improve.
That's good to hear.
And I just got off a good post today on Mark Z. Jacobson, one of our favorite windmill advocates.
Isn't he the guy that when he wants to do a emissions balance, he wants to include the emissions that would happen if we had a nuclear war?
Yes.
Okay.
And
he counsels against nuclear energy plants.
He is coming out with a new paper in which he builds on what I take to be fallacious assumptions and conclusions of his past papers, and he's excluding nuclear power from any consideration in his future energy schemes. And so I'm looking at the reasons why he's excluding nuclear power, and the post today had to do with his discussion of proliferation. And he seems to believe that if we don't build nuclear power plants, we can prevent nuclear proliferation.
That's a conceit that many people have, which is not borne out by reality.
Right. And so I just looked at that idea and the sort of arguments that he presented and did what is sometimes called fisking or deconstructing his views. And in the end, I concluded that either he was being extremely disingenuous, which is a polite way.
A possibility.
Or else he really doesn't know what he's talking about and has failed to do basic research for his paper.
Yeah. Well, Jacobson is another one of those people who I tend to put in the category of inflating their resumes. He is a legitimate professor of civil engineering
at Stanford,
which has little or nothing to do with power production. The last time I checked the curricula of civil engineering at most colleges around the country.
And Bill Hanrahan did a nice job of exposing his lack of familiarity with basic concepts of electrical engineering.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, actually, I hope that the concepts that you're talking about are basic concepts of electrical engineering, but around the country, one of the real areas that we need to encourage young people to get involved in is electrical power engineering, because most electrical engineering curricula around the country have over the last 20 to 25 years turned into electronics programs.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I've been told recently, we have a tremendous skill gap growing in the business of building such sexy devices as transformers and other switches and relays and all the things that make the vast machine called the electrical power grid actually function properly.
Yeah, and we have all these ambitious ideas about a smart grid.
Don't even get me started on that one.
Oh, Margaret, I want to hear you talk about smart grids, please.
And if we don't have the electrical engineers with the capacity to design electrical systems, the smart grid is going to be a dismal failure.
Well, you know, one of the problems that I see with a smart grid is people talk about those in terms of allowing renewable energy production systems to be more competitive in the market. But no matter how smart your controllers are, you can't control the output of a solar panel or a wind turbine.
Right.
Because you can't control the input. I mean, I don't know how you – I used to design control systems. That was one of the few things that I actually have a degree in. And you know, I don't know how you design a control system that varies the output of a windmill.
Well, the theory is that it allows them to take a distributed system and use energy. The wind is always blowing somewhere is the famous line, right?
Right, but aren't the people where the wind blowing using it?
Well, right, and there's a number of problems. But smart grid, the other thing that smart grid is touted for is the idea that they can control demand.
Right.
The real intent of smart grid, when you really get to poking at it, is the idea that they put smart meters on your house and they can control your demand.
So they can tell my house what to do.
When to run.
They
right.
can tell your appliances when to run.
Right. That's they can the turn your heat. Your air. The key is that they can turn your air conditioning off for what they call micro outages during the peak period usages during the day. That said, I went to the Smart Grid conference in 2009, in September of 2009, because I had harassed a friend of mine in EPRI about Smart Grid, and he finally said, shut up and come to the conference. So I spent my money. I went to the conference. I was the only nuclear consultant in the entire place. It was great. And I kept asking these questions, and people kept looking at me with these deer-in-the-headlights looks. But fundamentally, there's a couple things you should know. One is that they did a demo called Smart Grid City. Have you guys heard of this? Boulder, Colorado was converted to Smart Grid. And it turned out that it cost three times what was projected. They thought it was going to cost $15 million. It cost $45 million, one. Two, 90% of the residents refused to allow them to put smart meters on their houses, and they still got 90% of the benefit. Three, it turns out where the real issues were, where they saved the money, was in the distribution centers and the transmission yards. So there are aspects of smart grid that make a lot of sense in terms of improving your detection of faults in the lines to prevent outages. But the idea of smart grid is going to save us and prevent us, allow us to use solar and wind effectively and somehow limit usage and eliminate the peaks is a farce and absolutely not true. So, oh, yeah, smart grid's great.
You know, it's interesting. I actually had the opportunity, because I lived in an area of western Florida where there was at least some tentative attempts for the demand management stuff. And when I was there from 93 to 99, we signed up for the deal, and that would allow the utility company. They had a controller on our air conditioning power supply, our swimming pool pump power supply, and our water heater. And for during the peaks, they could turn each of those off for 15 minutes at a time. The pool pump they could turn off forever. You know, I could get that back in the wee hours in the morning, but the air conditioner they can only turn off for 15 minutes at a time. Now, if you've ever lived in the west central Florida during the summertime, you realize that if you lose your air conditioner and compressor for 15 minutes out of every hour, you cannot keep the temperature at what most people would consider to be a reasonably comfortable temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Our air conditioner was running the other 45 minutes solid, and we still were unable to stay below about 80 degrees
and it's
during
humid.
Some days. And it's humid. So anyway, that was I wasn't real happy with that controller.
I've often wondered about a phenomenon that people never mention when they say, well, you know, we can turn off your air conditioner for a certain amount of time and then it'll go back on. Well, in Ahmedabad, India, where my my daughter and son-in-law are now more or less, I think they may have all gone to see his relatives in Pune. But anyway, in Ahmedabad, India, the water is only on certain hours a day. So when the water is on in your neighborhood, you turn the water on. You fill your tank. You do whatever you need for the water for the rest of the day. So it gives the impression that if they had water on 24/7, my goodness, what a huge demand it would be. But of course, it isn't. It's just that people are trying to get 24 hours worth of water in 2.5 hours. And I feel that way about the air conditioner. You know, they're going to turn it off for 15 minutes. Well, then instead of the compressor running in some reasonable fashion for the whole hour, it's just going to run flat out the other 45 minutes.
That was what happened for us.
Right.
I'd hypothesize that the reason people in Boulder refuse to go with smart grids is because they're afraid of premium pricing. It's not that the devices would be turned off. It's that they would be charged onerous rates for using the electricity when they wanted it. And this is anytime you are allowed to put premium pricing on what has essentially been a commodity, you're going to get resistance to it.
There was an interesting sort of sub discussion going on at the Smart Grid conference I was at. I didn't go to the 2010, but I believe it hasn't changed. That it turns out that they would talk about that there were four classes of consumers, and they didn't really even admit to the issue that when you really get down to the brass tacks, it's not residential consumption that really swings it anyway. It's really industrial consumption that you got to get at if you're going to really lower demand. But well, that aside, they were talking about residential users, and they said there were four classes of residential users. There's the people who want to save money. There's the people who want to save the world. There's the people who want to beat their neighbor. And those are the three they talked about the most. And then they admitted to the fourth one, which is the people who just don't give a damn. That was 90%. And they kept talking about how to make people care. And I wrote blogs on this finally, because the issue is there's only one real way to make most of those people care. And you guys have hit it. It's in the pocketbook, right?
Right.
And electricity, when you look at your total your total bills and what you pay in the month for everything, electricity is typically about 15% or less of everything you pay. So if you want to start saving money, you don't go to your electric bill off the bat to try to lower it. You go elsewhere. You don't care about electricity. So the only way you're going to care is if the price goes up. Well, now you're in the same conundrum you get when gas goes to $4 a gallon. Everybody starts screaming about they can't afford this and it's hurting the poor and blah, 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 blah. So it's an unbreakable cycle. And it is the main reason that utilities want to put smart meters on houses, is to get at demand pricing. And Big Brother, you know, People just don't want somebody else control.
Shift of choice from the consumers to the producers, or the utilities.
Right. If you had true ability to buy competitive power, like what happened when they deregulated the phone service, and you could actually start to buy your phone service from somebody besides Ma Bell or the Baby Bells, you might be able to justify smart meters. But from a straight up, I can't go to anybody but Progress Energy for my electricity, so if they decide to jack the rates up, I can't do anything about it. Unless I want to put a windmill up in my backyard. Ooh, that'd be effective.
Well, of course.
I wanted to say that. I thought that in Europe there were little lights near your major equipment, and the light told you whether electricity was below or above a certain amount. There was time of day pricing.
And yeah, so basically, there's some aspects of that here in the U.S. I think Baltimore area was doing they had little glowing globes that they had in the houses of some of the Baltimore residents, and it would glow red if prices were high and green if prices were low for a somewhat demand-based. Here in North Carolina, you can do time-of-use pricing where I pay more for electricity during peak usage and less in off-peak. But it's voluntary. You can sign up for it or not. That's okay. It's the idea, though, that the problem with the smart meter is that it can change instantly, and there's no way for you as a regular person to be able to keep track of that infinitely changing, instantaneously changing pricing. I mean, glowing lights next year is great if you're home and you're looking at them, but if you're at work and it's an automatic timer kicking stuff on and off, you're screwed.
Well, that is the selling point, I guess, of the people that want to sell the smart grid, is you can set your devices yourself to automatically recognize that if the price gets above a certain level, well, it's not worth paying it anymore. We'll just turn off for a while.
Nobody owns those devices, though. And you're not gonna. This was the comment I kept making in the meeting, is those great visions of the future are wonderful, and I'd like to support them. But the refrigerator I bought in 2003, I'm not going to replace anytime soon. Right? And you can buy devices that you personally can hook onto your meter to keep track of your usage without having to trust your utility to not gouge you on it.
I think we're going to see more of what I consider to be blunt force pricing. And I'll give an example. In some cities, your sewage bill is based on your water use, which means if you use so many gallons of water during the course of a month, then they assume that that's your contribution to the sewage and you're billed accordingly. Well, guess what happens during the summer? People don't water their lawns because they know that watering their lawns is going to boost their sewage bill. Mm-hmm.
You know, interestingly enough, in where the place I just left in the near Baltimore, Maryland, that pricing situation is in play. But swimming pools are fairly popular in the area, so there's an awful lot of companies that have great big tanker trucks where they bring in the water, and the swimming pool owners will prove to the water company that they are not buying the water from them and not dumping it in the sewer, so that they avoid that kind of pricing. It's kind of interesting. So, you know, rather than filling up your swimming pool with city water, they bring in the tank from on a truck. Not a very energy efficient way to get water into your house, but such is life. Hey, I want to go back to this idea that this could be a one of a growing number of years where nuclear energy helps to solve some of these problems. One of the things that I've talked about for many years is the idea that nuclear doesn't have to be baseload power. It can be variable to the point where there's no real reason why the power in the middle of the day has to cost that much more than the power at night. The reason that we have to pay so much for power in the middle of the day now is because we We have to spool up a non-running, very inefficient natural gas-fired power plant that burns expensive fuel in order to meet the peak. What if we just had a little bit of extra capacity left on our nukes and spooled them up?
Well, that's one system. What I have been looking at is the potential to make reactor cost through the use of molten salt reactors low enough to produce daytime electricity or even peak demand electricity with your reactors. It can't be done with a conventional light water reactor, but if we can cut the cost of reactors by 50% or 75%, it can be done.
Well, there's 50 to 75% of the cost of current light water reactors that could be eliminated as we learn more about operating them and as we streamline some of the license applications and delays that we have built in to the cost structures right now. The cost that you see quoted for a finished product light water reactor is only a minor portion of that is actually the cost of the materials and construction process required to put a reactor together. An awful lot of it is risk premiums, it's extra people doing second and fourth and 17th checks, it's all kinds of things that have nothing to do with the cost of manufacturing pumps, manufacturing valves, manufacturing turbines. It's not straightforward. We still have some learning, have a lot of learning curve room available to us since we haven't built any new plants here in the U.S. in 30 years, and we've never built the kinds of reactors that we're getting ready to build now.
And just to correct something, the current designs, light water designs, can in fact load follow. Dwayne Arnold in Iowa load followed for many years in the 80s when the demand in Iowa was simply not sufficient to warrant base load on the plant. There's a couple of technical issues. Audience doesn't really care. But one of them is to keep in mind is one of the real issues is in a coal, same problem in a coal plant, it isn't really the heat rates, it's that huge turbine speeding up and slowing down.
Right. There's a lot of inertia there.
There's a lot of inertia there.
Both thermal and physical because the plants are so very large.
Right. But smaller plants, Dwayne Arnold being one of the smaller plants built here in the U.S., did in fact load follow for many years. KKM in Switzerland did some load following and does some rudimentary load following. But Dwayne Arnold actually load followed on a daily basis. It had a fairly standard cycle of low at night, high during the day that it did for a number of years.
I'm going to give you an opportunity, Margaret. What type of reactor is Dwayne Arnold?
Dwayne Arnold is a boiling water reactor. GE built it. I think it went commercial in the early 70s.
Because one of the things that is typically true about the boiling water reactors we have
boilers
in the US,
load follow a little better. Because
yes.
you can adjust the flow and have and change the power level rather straightforwardly and rather quickly with just a flow run down and run up. They work pretty well at it.
Yeah. I mean, my point has always been that people need to understand that fission as a physical process is extremely responsive.
Oh, yeah. It's 6 seconds.
Right. It's the plant around it that we have to design if we want to do a little bit of load following and adjusting to meet demands.
Yeah.
But we, as engineers, can make those choices with a nuclear plant. Whereas you cannot make the choice to make a wind turbine be a load follower.
Load follower, no.
Right. Yeah, no, it's never going to adequately load follow. Nuke plants do well at load following. Usually the reason they don't load follow with them today here in the U.S. is besides the whole inertia issue, is it's the cheapest power available to the grid. Why in the world would you load follow with your cheapest available power source? You load follow with your most expensive power source so that you maximize the dollars being printed.
Which is true, except in the Northwest. Because now we're load following with our hydroelectric dams, which are in fact cheaper than nukes.
Yes, and that's mostly because the hydroelectric is a little more easily responsive to the problem, and it's a you aren't wasting the fuel in a way. In the nuke plant, when you do a lot of load following, you throw neutrons away.
You have a limited amount of hours a year that you can draw out of a hydroelectric facility.
That's true.
And well, that varies depending on the weather.
So you want to reserve that for times where you can maximize your profit.
Well, and kind of ironically, they're being forced to do some of that in order to protect the fish.
Well, one of the load following challenges that is happening in the Pacific Northwest is as we bring on more and more wind capacity, the hydroelectric dams are pretty the best able to follow the load.
Yes.
So what really happens, if you have a lot of wind capacity in an area with hydro as the alternative, is that wind doesn't reduce your emissions at all. Because the generator that's actually changing power as the wind comes up and down is something that doesn't produce any emissions anyway.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that, because if you imagine a situation where your hydro plant can only run a certain number of hours in a year, as Charles said, and if you have a wind turbine, it runs, and then when it stops running, the hydro plant kicks in, so that basically you add to the hours that the wind turbine is using no emissions, the hours that the hydro plant is using no emissions. I actually think they're a pretty good pair, and that's why they have been moderately successful in Denmark, because Denmark on its own really couldn't do it, but basically couldn't use wind all that effectively, even though they say they do and so forth. But the reason they're actually using it effectively is they've paired themselves with Norway and Sweden's dams, so that when the wind fails in Denmark, then Norway and Sweden turn on their hydro.
Yeah, but the analysis is really a little bit more complicated than that, because I know that in the Pacific Northwest right now, the dams or the rivers below the dams have a certain minimum amount of water they have to be flowing through them in order to keep the fish happy. Okay? So if the wind kicks up and they need less and less power from the dam, they end up actually bypassing the turbine to let the water flow down the river anyway, without producing any electricity, in order to keep the river flowing. So in some cases, all the wind turbine is doing is bypassing a dam and really doing nothing to improve anybody's life, other than the fact that for every kilowatt hour that the wind turbine owner generates, you generous people, plus me, plus everybody else in America, gives the wind turbine owner 2.1 cents for every kilowatt hour they generate, regardless of whether anybody needs to buy the power or not.
And, of course, they've been...
Sorry, 2.1 cents. I think I said something different. 2.1 cents for every kilowatt hour.
Yeah, and there have been situations in Texas where the wind generator people have paid the grid to take their power.
Right. Well, they paid the grid less than 2.1 cents, but they collect 2.1 cents from all of us. So in some cases, they're using some of our money to pay somebody to be the disposal for their power that nobody wants at that time. See, that's the problem. People want power when they want power. When it's not necessary, it's sort of a waste. So what's do you think is going to happen with the $8 billion addition to what was remaining in the $18.5 billion loan guarantee fund? I think by my numbers, we're somewhere around back to $18 billion that's available for a loan guarantee. Am I pretty close there, Dan?
Yeah, I think you are. And I think what you're going to do is come back to DOE's shortlist that's been around all this time with one possible addition. I do think that Calvert Cliffs will find a way to bring in other American investors, as I indicated earlier, by selling slices of the capacity of the Areva EPR. It's a 1,600 megawatt reactor, and you could sell, hypothetically speaking, 100 megawatt slices to different investors, and they'd all be American companies, and you'd satisfy the legal requirement, leaving aside the arguments pro or con for it. Second is that NRG is also a merchant in Texas, has early stage financing from TEPCO prior to the NRC license, which is a major confidence booster in terms of financial due diligence as far as DOE is concerned. So I think they would be in line for a loan guarantee. SCANA has said that they may not need a loan guarantee. They might proceed without it. And also South Carolina Electric and Gas is thinking of selling off its share of the SCANA project, and Duke is thinking of buying it rather than building the new William States Lee plant. They would just buy 500 megawatts of SCANA, which also would increase the financial profile. So those are all there. You still have some money left over. And it's also not clear that each utility is going to need the full 80% of the cost of reactor as a loan guarantee, given the fact that they have other investors, which opens you to the fifth candidate, or the Miss America runner-up in the beauty contest, and that's Luminant's Comanche Peak. That's a very interesting reactor project because it is the first iteration, first time that Mitsubishi's 1,700 megawatt advanced pressurized water reactor design, which is still undergoing NRC design certification, has been proposed, and they're proposing to build two of them down there south of Fort Worth. And then there's also another dark horse in the picture, and that's Dominion, which set aside its earlier commitment to GE Hitachi's ESBWR, which comes in several flavors, and instead has gone ahead and made a great big deal out of their fact that they're going ahead with a preliminary work on another Mitsubishi reactor. That gives Mitsubishi two placeholders in the American market. And so I think you have a toss-up, at least between Comanche Peak and Dominion. And frankly, I know Dominion has, I don't know if Dominion has submitted an application or not. I suspect they have. If you look at Luminant's debt and you look at Dominion's financial position, then you know, I think it's a tough choice for Department of Energy. So I think those are the choices that are facing them. There's been a lot of hoo-ha about the politics of Constellation, but when you come down to it, it's a mature project. It's well defined. The license application is pretty far along. The reactor design is increasingly well understood by the NRC, and so they just have to round up American investors, and I think they're back in the game. So I'm not particularly worried about that.
And then you also have some other, you know, minor issues, like the fact that Steny Hoyer is in fact a Democrat. So is the governor of Maryland.
Right.
So is the entire state of Maryland, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So if you're going to choose between Texas, which is a Republican state, and Maryland, which is a Democrat, and you're the Obama administration, gee, flip a coin. Which one are you going to give the money to?
Well, and particularly with what you just said, can you imagine giving two loans to Texas and none to Maryland?
Yeah, well, that wouldn't fly.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
That would be a rather politically inastute.
Well, there's precedent for this, too. And you go back to the some years ago when there was plans for a super collider in Texas. And this during the Clinton administration.
There's still a hole there, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And there was a Senate election in Texas. And Texas sent Kay Bailey Hutchinson to Washington, a Republican. The day after the election, the Clinton administration pulled the plug on the project.
Well, that's not the first time that's ever happened. There used to be a very large naval base in Newport, Rhode Island. At the time, the Newport, Rhode Island was almost as big as Norfolk, Virginia, in terms of housing a naval base. But I think there was a guy named Richard Nixon. Yeah, Richard Nixon, who decided that he was angry at the entire Northeast, and he eliminated the naval base. It actually didn't really eliminate it. They still have a school there, but all the ships left.
Well, yeah, Massachusetts was one of the few states that voted against the central electoral votes to the Democrat in that election, and they suffered for it under Richard Nixon. Now, getting back to the loan guarantee and the due diligence process, DOE clearly has probably learned something from the Constellation, and that is that they've got to have more involvement from the White House relative to direction being given to them. Be left to its own devices, OMB will descend to geek level analysis, irrespective of political considerations.
I wish they went to geek level analysis, because a geek would actually not use the same number for every project. But instead, they came up with a fixed number that is irrespective of the quality of the applicant, which is a really dumb way to do a very large loan guarantee. Well, it may work for giving guarantees for student loans where there's a very large sample and you can't tell one from another. But it's very silly to use a single number to evaluate a small number of large projects.
Agreed. I think what you wind up with is it's how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, and OMB's evaluating Constellation with the same skepticism that you would of putting a spaceport in Idaho, okay? I think you really need to come back to the question of, look, we need nuclear power plants. These guys have an investment profile that makes sense. Would you please just give them a loan guarantee and move on? I mean, somebody from the White House has to say that to OMB, tell Congress they've said that to OMB, and then get the job done.
Yeah, you're far too generous. The guy who left OMB after ensuring that that loan didn't go through is part of the establishment, part of the people that don't like nuclear power one way or another. And he got a very good job after leaving. So, anyway, I'm a cynic about rich bankers.
Okay, I think that's clear.
Well, good. I don't want to keep it a secret. You know, I just,
well, no worries there, Rod.
Okay, good.
The energy situation is becoming. It is moving towards becoming very critical, and the president needs to be aware that if he wants to be president after 2012, he needs to start stepping up to the plate on energy, including nuclear power.
Maybe he doesn't want to be president anymore. He's not necessarily had a happy time.
Actually, he's done fairly well this year, despite the congressional losses. He's got a lot of legislation passed.
Oh, I understand. I'm just saying that he doesn't look like he's having fun. That's the I'm
saying. Well, who would have fun being president of the United States?
You know, the Republicans are coming into power in the House, and Fred Upton's going to be from Michigan is going to be heading up a key committee on energy. And I think the important thing for the Republicans is for their PR machine to get their names straight. Upton is famous for having put out a press release, and Meredith knows about this, saying that if Vermont Yankee closes, it'll be the first domino that will fall. Unfortunately, the PR machine for the Republicans picked up on this and sent out a press release to major newspapers saying that a reactor in Domino's Falls, Vermont, is under pressure from anti-nukes.
What was this? I don't remember.
Oh, God.
So many releases would go by. Which one was this, Dan? Could you?
We'll put a link in the show notes. I'll have to get that story from you, Dan.
Okay.
Because that's pretty interesting. You know, the domino theory is one that I'm really concerned about. I know that there are people who are well organized to do everything they can to shut down as many nukes as possible. You know, we've talked about on the show before, the Vermont Yankee issue. Oyster Creek is now going to shut down 10 years early. Indian Point is still not got its water permit. And I would imagine that there are still other plants who are under the gun. Although, nicely enough, I believe the plant that Margaret mentioned in Iowa got its license extension in a...
Yes, and amazingly, there was very little protest in the state. It's located very near the University of Iowa, which in Iowa is the collection of hippies left over from the Vietnam era that used to go out every summer and protest at Duane Arnold.
Maybe they've mellowed out over the years.
Well, they run a... Interestingly enough, I have a friend in the area. I grew up in Iowa, so I know a lot of people around in there. But there, I had a friend who did triathlons in the area of Cedar Rapids near the plant. And the swim portion of a triathlon they did in the cooling pond.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Well, if we look at plants, take Oyster Creek just to take your example. Oyster Creek, first of all, Morningstar was very clear in their analysis of the situation that Oyster Creek was a high-maintenance, low-margin plant, and it was only a matter of time until Exelon pulled the pin on it. Anyway, that was their assessment financially. So I'm not sure that you can give credit to the cooling tower controversy 100% relative to that. Exelon may have been looking at the issue of high maintenance cost, return on assets, and thinking, okay, we can squeeze another 10 years out of this, but after that, it's a crapshoot. Let's pull the pin and blame it on the cooling towers, and our stockholders won't be mad at us.
Right, and our stockholders will actually be very happy because we reduce the supply of electricity in the area, the price for electricity in all of our other plants will go up.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Exelon has a fossil plant on the other side of the Delaware River, which will benefit from that. The other thing is that Indian Point will probably wind up taking their rates versus cooling towers issue to court because the Supreme Court has ruled that states can take cost benefit into account. The state of New York doesn't want to. Interestingly enough, Riverkeeper, which is the primary environmental group opposed to the continued operation of Indian Point, was the organization that brought the suit when they lost.
Wasn't Riverkeeper formed by a guy named Robert F. Kennedy Jr.?
He was one of the formers of the people who formed it, but there were others. And I think that Energy will ultimately have to litigate the issue because the state of New York is just turned them down on in terms of their administrative law review that took place in December. So that's going to eventually, I think, wind up going to court. And as Meredith, I think, has talked about numerous times, some of the options in Vermont include the sale of reactor. Energy's been forthright saying, you know, hey, we're looking for somebody to sell it to. Then there's the issue of what I consider to be power piracy, which is if the new owner of Vermont Yankee made a big enough contribution to the community renewable energy fund or whatever it's called in Vermont.
Yeah, clean energy development.
Right. That would buy off the solar and wind people from making too much noise about nuclear power, and you could have another 20 years that way. There's a new boy on the block, and that's out here in Ohio. Davis Bessie, which is over by Toledo, has a troubled history, and they've just gotten a new lid, which they're putting on, but they're coming up for license renewal.
That's their second new lid, right?
Right, yeah. And they're in the anti-nukes over there, held an organizational meeting in December, and about 40 or 50 people showed up, got quite a bit of coverage in the Toledo Blade, which has been very opposed to the plant editorially, and which has run a number of critical articles about the plant. So I think you need to keep your eye on that because, frankly, I think it's the next place where you're going to see anti-nukes convene. The locals brought in a number of national anti-nuke organizations, including Beyond Nuclear, to help them get organized. So watch Davis Bessie because I think that's next.
Isn't Harvey Wasserman an Ohio resident?
I hope not.
I think he is, as a matter of fact.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll have to find out.
Yeah. He wrote a piece on the 31st of December talking about how excited he was about the successes that the anti-nuclear movement has had in shutting down some of these plants. Now, one of the things that's interesting to me is I've had some discussions on my blog recently about it with a guy who's been trying to talk about the emissions of nuclear plants and the life cycle emissions and how we aren't anywhere near as clean as a windmill and stuff. But that particular argument becomes very interesting when you look at the activity of people who are trying to force perfectly well-maintained, already built nuclear plants to shut down. Because most of those emissions that are associated with with nuclear plants is in the construction process, in the concrete, in the steel, in the cranes, and everything that it takes to build the nuclear plant. Once that investment in energy has been made, isn't it silly if you're really concerned about emissions to shut down the plant?
Well, yeah, they're constantly pushing all those things together. I mean, we find that to be the case here. You know, we're Vermont Law School. People write papers with very questionable papers about how nuclear plants are too expensive or they make too much emissions and so forth. And it's all about new nuclear plants. And meanwhile, they somehow feel that all this is relevant to Vermont Yankee, but it isn't. I mean, nobody's planning to build Vermont Yankee. It's already there.
Right. And all the capital investment, which again is the high part, the large component of nuclear total cost, is already made. I mean, that investment's already been done. This is why I keep trying to get people at least interested in saying, why is Exelon so adamant about destroying the Zion nuclear station, which maybe, I don't know, I haven't been there, I haven't been able to do an analysis of the plant physically, but from what I've been told, it's in pretty decent condition and could be restored for a lot less than the cost of building a brand new nuke.
Well, let's just put one that thing in perspective. Let's go to TVA. TVA is completing Watts Bar, completed on time and on budget in 2012. They brought Browns Ferry back, and that's now operating. And they recovered the cost of reinvesting in Browns Ferry in less than 2 years. And now they're working on reviving the construction license for one of the Bellefonte plants. The other one probably is just got lost too much stuff, and they can't bring it back. So these things are different for different utilities. And by the way, TVA is one of the biggest peak gas operators in the country. I think they have 15 gigawatts of peak gas capacity that's available to them for summer power. So different utilities operate out of different business models. And I don't think you can paint with a very broad brush here. I think you have to paint with a little bit finer brush.
And I think, though, that one can look at what TVA did with Browns Ferry. And I can tell you that none of those plants had been, I won't say not terribly well maintained, but there was a lot of scavenging going on when they restarted 2 and 3 from Browns Ferry 1. So when they decided to restart Browns Ferry 1, they had to do a significant amount of work. That was not a straightforward clean it up and, you know, scrub the mold off and get it going again. And yet they found it to be a cost-effective maneuver. And, you know, if Exelon doesn't think it's a cost-effective maneuver to restart Zion, I certainly am not going to say that Exelon is wrong, but I would say that perhaps another company might find that interesting, and it seems like Exelon has taken that just off the table. The idea of selling the plant to someone else who might want to refurbish it seems to not be a consideration, which is unfortunate.
Yep. Interestingly enough, I don't know if you all have read that recently Germany announced not only are they maintaining the 17 plants that are currently operating, but they have two plants that got shut down in about 2007 that are going to be restored to use.
Really?
Yeah, because the reason they were shut down in 2007...
Was it trade?
Well, sort of. The way that the rule was in Germany was that there were a certain number of reactor years available,
right.
And if you shut down one plant early, you could move the reactor years to other plants.
Right.
And these plants both needed some maintenance, and the utility that owned them said, you know, rather than invest money in fixing these plants, we'll just shut them down. we'll transfer the reactor years to some of our other plants and move forward. But I just read that, and they're both pretty large plants, because Germany is, you know, when they built plants, they were about 1,400 megawatts or something. They were big plants. And they've looked and said, you know, we know there's a fuel tax, we know there's these things, but if we can operate those plants for 14 years, good. We're going to restore them to operation and bring them back into service.
Also, well, that's one of the things I think about Oyster Creek. Everybody's like, oh my gosh, Oyster Creek is going to be shut down in 10 years. They've signed everything. They're going to do it. Well, yeah, but, you know, if 10 years from now the price of natural gas is what I expect it's going to be, they may relook at it again and say, oh, maybe that's not as good an idea. It's sort of like when you really get down to it, when Sweden really got to the point where it's going to shut down its plants and begin buying natural gas from Russia, they're like,
No, I don't think so.
Well, yeah. And the other thing you got to keep in mind with Oyster Creek is that what they've done is what the government does all the time. They kicked the can down the road.
Right.
Exactly.
And in terms of what's going to happen in energy, 10 years is almost an eternity.
It's an eternity. It's an absolute eternity.
Right. I mean, just think about trying to make a prediction for what the price of oil would be from the viewpoint of 1966. Who in 1966 would have said that by 1976 the price of oil would be $14 a barrel, because at the time they were paying about $2 a barrel in 1966.
Right.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, the natural gas things that you're reading about today sound to me almost identical to what I was reading in the 1990s, and I can show you some of the predictions from the Energy Information Agency, because I went and found some of their archives of their energy outlook, and they said, hey, natural gas is $2 a million BTU. It's going to go up at a rate less than the rate of inflation for the next 20 years. And guess what? It didn't. My prediction for natural gas by the end of 2011, you will see $6.50 natural gas. Right now, it's $4. So I predict a 50% price increase in natural gas this year.
I think you may be right. I'm not sure I'd put that number on it, but my own feeling about it is similar to something I saw in the 80s, which I was thinking I might blog about, which is when they began saying, oh, you know, we're going to have all this deep well natural gas, and so we're going to have this whole new bunch of natural gas, and the prices began to just gyrate like crazy.
Mm-hmm. It's a volatile commodity.
Right.
In many ways.
You know, one of the things is I regularly look at the oil drum, and they have interesting things to say about the future of natural gas. They're not nearly as impressed as some of the people on the Energy Collective about it.
All right. Well, you know, I just think I lost Margaret, perhaps because we've gone now to about an hour and 16 minutes. It's been a joy to be back together with you all. I hope that we can get together again soon. Want to wish you all a happy new year, and I want
happy
to give
new
you
year
each,
to you, Rod.
Give each of you the opportunity to provide one more time where your blog is, what your URL is, and Meredith, for you, tell us one more little bit about the Ethan Allen Energy Project.
Okay. Well, I'll start by saying, my blog is at yesvy.blogspot, and it's about Vermont Yankee. The Ethan Allen Energy Education Project is an opportunity for people who are in favor of nuclear and other traditional methods of energy to get the word out about exactly why you need baseload power and what a transmission loss is, and basically some education. And I would like people to join it. You can join it at the at its website, which is energyeai.org, all one word, energyeai, which for Ethan Allen Institute, .org, and it's $30 for the year. I'm going after some bigger donors this year, and I would like to have a lot of memberships at the $30 level. I mean, I'm happy to take more, but right now I'm really asking to grow the membership list.
Okay. Thank you. Charles?
Okay. My name is Charles Martin. My blog is Nuclear Green. It's nucleargreen.blogspot.com. I'm look at issues like the future of nuclear power, energy planning, the cost of energy, future costs of energy, in addition to looking at nuclear power, I do reviews of plans for renewable energy systems. I also look at the history of nuclear power back to the Manhattan Project.
Back to your childhood at Oak Ridge.
Yes, back to the people whose feet I sat and listened to their tales.
Dan?
Just before I close up, Rod, I would mention that you and I, by the way, both have written about SL1, and Monday, tomorrow, is the 50th anniversary of the accident at SL1, and hopefully those ghosts are going to be buried once and for all relative to the tragic events that took place there, but I just thought I'd mention that. I blog at Idaho Samets app. I use what Amazon calls a statistically improbable set of letters, DJYSRV, that would be in Pilot Talk, Delta, Juliet, Yankee, Sierra, Romeo, Victor at blog.blogspot.com, or just look up Idaho Samizdat. Samizdat is a Russian word for self-published, which I thought was very appropriate for a nuclear blog that includes non-proliferation topics as well as the economics and politics of reactors. Also, the other thing that I do is I think I'm the only blog that covers the uranium mining industry, at least from the pro-nuclear community in any case.
Yep, and it's got good stuff, particularly for those of us who occasionally like to try to make a little money on the side from investing in companies that we really believe in and products that we really believe in, like uranium, which has been very, very nice to me this year. So, all right. Hope you all have a happy new year, happy nuke year, and for those of you who burn natural gas and to heat your homes, pray that I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. Take care.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
There's a way, such a better way, today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.